A beautifully designed Squarespace website is the difference between thinking about photography school and selling your portraits online. It's the difference between giving away those cookies you just made for free and running your cookie empire. A beautifully designed Squarespace website is the difference between having a movie reviewing hobby and a movie reviewing career. Squarespace, because no matter what you're into, a website makes it real. Use offer code THEDIFFERENCE for 30% off select plans. Terms and conditions apply.
What if you could see what's happening inside your body? Prenuvo's whole body scan screens for hundreds of conditions, including many solid tumors, as early as stage one, all in under an hour. And now, you can go beyond imaging. With 80-plus blood biomarkers that help complete the picture, this Labor Day, save $300 off your scan when you book at prenuvo.com. That's prenuvo.com. Save $300 now through September 8th at prenuvo.com. Terms and conditions apply.
Every week on the Moth Podcast, you'll hear true stories that will intrigue you, inspire you, and make you laugh.
He said, is there anything in your diet that might be spiking your blood sugar? I said, sometimes I eat pizza until I'm unconscious. He said, I think that might be it.
For real stories live on stage from comedians, astronauts, accountants, farmers, and people just like you, follow and listen to The Moth wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Sunday Take, May 25th, 2025. It has been 5 years to the day since George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis. And so on this Memorial Day weekend, I thought it was a good time to reflect in a Sunday morning conversation. We're going to talk to Nikema Levy Armstrong about her reflections 5 years later. As an activist well ahead of George Floyd, what did she see? What did she know? And where are we 5 years later? And then we're going to talk to Andy Mannix, who has covered the story for 5 years for the Star Tribune. I hope you're having a peaceful Sunday. I hope you're enjoying your cup of coffee. And I hope you enjoy and appreciate these conversations. I'm Blaise Olson. This is Sunday Take.
What if you could see what's happening inside your body? Prenuvo's whole body scan screens for hundreds of conditions, including many solid tumors, as early as stage one, all in under an hour. And now, you can go beyond imaging. With 80-plus blood biomarkers that help complete the picture, this Labor Day, save $300 off your scan when you book at prenuvo.com. That's prenuvo.com. Save $300 now through September 8th at prenuvo.com. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, y'all, I'm Maddie.
And I'm Poodle.
And together, we host the podcast Reality Gaze.
We are two ridiculous homosexuals who love nothing more than talking about reality television
and tearing in a new one. So whether it's 90 Day Fiancé, Love is Blind, Love After Lockup, or any other trash TV show about lonely hearts looking for love, your gay besties got you covered, y'all.
New shows every week. Follow and listen to Reality Gaze wherever you get your podcast.
Reality Gaze, let's love!
Joining me now is Nikema Levy Armstrong. She is an activist, a lawyer. She has been one of the most visible activists and voices in Minnesota and nationally, and was well ahead of George Floyd's killing. Nikema, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Let's just start with reflections. I think that's what I'm doing this weekend and trying to think about where and how I was when it happened, the days that followed. Just talk about 5 years after George Floyd's death, what you are thinking about and where you are today in thinking about this.
I've spent a lot of time in recent weeks reflecting upon the moment that I learned that the Minneapolis police had killed someone on May 25th of 2020. And I think about how normal the day started out. Just a regular Memorial Day, relaxing at home with my family. And suddenly that peace that I had was disrupted, and rightfully so, when I was tagged in a Facebook post by a woman named Ashley Canones, whose husband, Brian Quinones, had actually been killed by the Richfield and Edina Police Department 2 or 3 years earlier. And it caused her to become an activist. And so she tagged me and a few other people on a Facebook post that day saying that the Minneapolis police had killed someone by choking them or crushing their throat. And of course, I was shocked to hear this news. So I immediately went online and did a search, and there was absolutely no information there. And so I thought, okay, maybe this is a mistake. Now let me do some further investigating. So I picked up the phone and I called Chief Madeira Arredondo. And I said, and he answered the phone because it was nighttime by this point. And I said, Rondo, did the Minneapolis police kill someone today? And he said, no, Miss Nakima. Someone died as a result of a medical emergency while being taken into custody. But I've already turned over the case to the BCA, which is the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Mm-hmm. And I said, are you sure? Because the community has a different perspective about what happened. And then I relayed to him what Ashley said. And then I said that, and I asked him if he had seen video of the incident. He said he had not. And I said, okay, I'll call you back. And so after I got off the phone, I immediately took to Facebook and I wrote a post letting people know that something had happened. And I said, this is what Ashley said. And this is what the chief said. Now we need to see some video. Literally moments later, I was tagged in another Facebook post. This time it was the video that was captured by then 17-year-old Darnella Frazier. The video that was literally seen around the world in the days and weeks and months after the killing of who we now know to be George Floyd. And so I just was shocked when I pushed play and saw what I saw. It transported me back into time. From the stories that I had heard or read or movies I had watched about the lynching era, that is what this video was reminiscent of. To see a white police officer, who we now know as Derek Chauvin, kneeling on the neck of George Floyd as he begged for mercy, said he couldn't breathe and called out for his mother. And as I watched in horror, tears started to stream down my face. And I then shared the video with the trigger warning, and I immediately picked up the phone and called Chief Arredondo back and told him about the video, and then I sent it to him, and I said, they killed that man. And that was a moment I will never forget, that entire experience on Memorial Day. So Memorial Day doesn't feel the same to me anymore after what we all witnessed and experienced.
As you reflect on that, and I reflect, you know, this Memorial Day weekend with that same calm, because I think we all try to find that calm on holiday weekends. And I know you went to George Floyd Square yesterday. Talk about the community, the people you talk to, where they think we've come in 5 years, how much farther Minneapolis and Minnesota have to go on race relations and race issues, and how can we continue to have a constructive conversation about these things 5 years later?
Well, I think the mood of the people in and around George Floyd Square is one of still grappling with what happened 5 years ago, because for many of us, it still feels like it happened yesterday, or that it was a dream or happened in a different lifetime, yep. Right? It's just so many mixed emotions. And I think that when you're at George Floyd Square, you realize that we're still at a standstill in many ways. The city and the community haven't yet reconciled how to memorialize this tragic incident that occurred and how to seamlessly or more naturally incorporate this memorial site into the fabric of the community. Because whether anyone likes it or not, it is a permanent part of the community. And I'm referring to George Floyd Square and the memorial site. What I saw was folks trying to find a way forward in their own spirit, in the sense of feeling grounded after experiencing something that was, I think, a huge awakening for a lot of people, a source of a great deal of trauma and uncertainty and fear, but also some sense of relief that finally the world took notice of what Black people had been trying to tell elected officials in Minneapolis for many, many years and even decades before George Floyd was killed. So I think even in the midst of that grappling and the grief and trauma that people are still dealing with, people want to have hope. They want to find a way that we can move forward and resolve the underlying issues that actually led to the murder of George Floyd. But the question in my mind remains is whether or not the desire of the people to find a resolution that is just is in alignment with the desires of those who are in positions of power. Because in order to get to a place of justice, and we know some measure of justice has happened in the sense that the four officers who murdered George Floyd were fired. They were charged criminally at the state and federal levels. They were arrested and ultimately convicted. That was major in the grand scheme of things. But there is a deeper level of reckoning and reconciliation that needs to happen. And it requires, I would say, more humility, vulnerability, a willingness to listen, a willingness to examine the facts and the different mechanisms within these systems, whether it's city government or the police department or our law enforcement apparatus as a whole. And that seems to be something that the people in power are not yet willing to do, even 5 years after the murder of George Floyd, which, as you know, caused a global uprising, the largest mass movement in world history.
You know, it's interesting you say it that way, because one of the things that, you know, my bubble, the world I live in, I think there is so much more consciousness, awareness about racial issues. I think, you know, as somebody who grew up in the Twin Cities and had heard things, but obviously as a white guy, I never experienced it. Okay. I'll just be blunt. Mm-hmm. You and I knew each other before this, and you were raising some of these alarms before. Is when you're in the community, and I mean the whole city or the whole Twin Cities, not, you know, one part of the city or one group of people, do you sense people are still aware, or have they just moved on and discounted it? Because I think body cams in police officers have improved, obviously spread wider. Everybody's got a phone. There is just more transparency on everything, but there's less trust in the institutions. And so I'm just trying to, in my own way, figure out where we're at in this, you know, in this rebuilding trust for the future. Not about the past, but how do we, you know, build trust in these institutions going forward And what do you see in the community when you talk to people?
Well, I have a few thoughts on that. I have gotten to the point of revisiting this notion of whether it is necessary to have trust of institutions in order to move forward. And I honestly don't think that that is a necessary component anymore. Trust is something that's earned, but it is a word that is often tossed out by law enforcement officials and the government after a critical incident, saying it's time to rebuild trust. How can we rebuild trust when the elements of building trust have never been present? We have never gone back and fully examined the underlying issues that led to the murder of George Floyd. And as I said before about our systems, what mechanisms in our systems allowed for this to happen? And what are the threats that still exist within the system that could allow this to happen again? So if we're not willing to have that conversation, which would include having to dive into historical records, have an honest analysis of what is found there, and put a cohesive story together that includes the voices of those who have been crying out, we're not going to get there. Now, I think we could get there, but I don't think that the political will is there to move things forward in that manner. We can't just gloss over what happened and say that was 5 years ago. Now, how do we move forward? That's like someone engaging in a physical assault of another person. And after the assault, their face is battered and bruised. And over time, that person's visible wounds heal. And then the person who did the assault approaches them and says, now how can we move on? As if the assault never happened, because visibly you cannot see the effects. That's how I see what's going on right now. And I think for residents of Minneapolis, it's going to depend on the backgrounds of the individuals in terms of how they're processing things. For many Minneapolis residents who live a more privileged lifestyle in which they have not had these kinds of experiences, or they can hear about some things but tune them out, there's not really pressure to go deeper in terms of unpacking. Well, when I heard that this happened to Jamar Clark, or when I heard that this happened to Philando Castile, why didn't I roll up my sleeves and get involved and try to get to the bottom of this? After all, our tax dollars go to support these very systems that we're talking about. And some of the people working in these systems could be my neighbor. They could be someone I voted for. So where is my responsibility in digging a little bit deeper than the headlines and getting to the root of the problem? I don't think that that's where most Minneapolis residents are. And there's really no incentive other than some folks who might be fearful that it could happen again to dig more deeply. But for Black residents, Native American residents, Latinx residents, Somali residents, we don't have the luxury of tuning out and hoping that someday things will miraculously change. Why? Because the threats still exist in terms of what can happen if a police officer decides to pull someone over, or if they're called out to a 911 call and they make the decision to use deadly force with or without justification. Those are things that are still very serious risks for the most vulnerable members of our community. And if folks don't believe me, all they need to do is look at what happened since George Floyd was killed. So as we know, he was murdered on May 25th of 2020. And then on February 2nd, I believe, of 2022, we had the Minneapolis police killing of 22-year-old Amir Locke in a botched no-knock warrant situation in a downtown Minneapolis apartment building. Now, this occurred less than 2 years after this worldwide uprising demanding justice for George Floyd, after elected officials pledged that they would address police accountability issues, after the mayor of Minneapolis promised voters that he had banned no-knock warrants. So think about that. And the implications of being told these things, and then in reality, the threat still exists. Or you have someone like Sunday or Tekle Sundberg, who is a Black man who had been adopted by a white family and who had a mental health crisis. And this was, again, after George Floyd and after Amir Locke. And instead of law enforcement officers responding in a way that showed that they learned their lessons from George Floyd and from Amir Locke, they responded in a way that was similar to what they would have done had the murder of George Floyd not taken place, which was to dehumanize a Black man in a state of crisis and to use deadly force on him. Instead of de-escalating, instead of bringing in mental health professionals, instead of taking all available opportunities to preserve his life. So these things are still going on. It's not like we can say, oh, it's been 5 years. No, these are things that are still going on to this day. You think about what happened to Davis Maturi, a Black man living in Minneapolis, a homeowner with a family, who started receiving threats from his white unhinged neighbor and started making calls to the Minneapolis Police Department, raising alarm bells that this neighbor was threatening him and other people of color in the neighborhood. He made so many calls to 911, yet he was still shot and almost killed by his neighbor. And then after the shooting, it took the Minneapolis Police Department 5 days to go in and arrest the neighbor who had done such a heinous and vile act against Mr. Maturi. This was recent. This wasn't 7 years ago, 5 years ago, or even 3 years ago. This all happened within the last year or so. So we're not as far ahead as some people would like for us to be, and it's because we haven't done the real work that this requires.
As we close here, my conversation with Nakima Levy Armstrong, what are two things you want to see in the next year? The city of Minneapolis has an election. Public safety, civil rights will be on the ballot in many ways. The conversation will happen. What are two things you think need to be talked about and change that could change quick in Minneapolis?
I think, of course, number one, we need new leadership in this city. We need a new mayor and we need a new chief of police at a minimum in order to move things forward. We cannot believe the stories that are being told by this current mayor in the face of the Trump administration making the decision to withdraw from the federal consent decree process before it's even had a chance to begin. And in response to that, we're hearing the mayor say, and the chief, we are going to still follow the federal consent decree. We're going to follow every word of it, every line of it. Why would anyone in their right minds believe that? This is the same mayor who said he banned no-knock warrants. And then after people believed that promise and went to the polls and voted for him, we had the killing of Amir Locke, as I just referenced. So I think that we have to not be delusional this time in terms of thinking that the current leadership is equipped or serious about addressing these issues. So that's one thing. And in order for that to happen, that means that residents of Minneapolis, including and especially the folks that Chief O'Hara called the progressive bourgeois part of the city,
yeah,
will need to take responsibility for mobilizing their neighbors, the ones who are most likely to go to the polls, the ones who have a lot of power in choosing the next leaders of the city, and say that we need a change and be serious about it and get to know some of the other candidates who are running for office and question them very seriously about their skills and qualifications, their track records, and their integrity as well. That's going to make a huge difference. But if those in our city who are seen as the most desirable or the prime voting block or the most privileged continue to believe some of the lies and delusions, we'll be back in the same boat after November's election. And that's what I don't want to see, because those who are disenfranchised may not go to the polls, even though they know we need new leadership, because a lot of folks have lost hope in the political system as a mechanism to change things. So I would like to see people in our community have some level of hope. I'm not saying trust, but some level of hope that if they're able to organize and mobilize and find a candidate that they can truly believe in, that they will go to the polls as well and be a part of the change that we want to see. So those are some of the things I want to see happen. And then I would say the other thing that I've been having conversations with people about in philanthropy and community and government is the fact that we still need some type of racial reckoning within the city of Minneapolis. I think about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was formed in South Africa to examine the effects of apartheid and to document people's testimonials about their experience and to put in place some mechanisms such that that type of regime and brutality would not happen again in South Africa. That is actually the type of rigorous process that we will need in Minneapolis in order to undo, or at a minimum, begin to repair decades of harm that was allowed to happen at the hands of the Minneapolis Police Department and through the neglect and indifference of elected officials.
Nikema, thanks for this conversation, and we'll touch base soon.
Thank you, Blois.
When we come back, more on the 5th anniversary of George Floyd's killing. I'm Blois Olson. You're listening to News Talk 830 WCCO. My final guest this week on Sunday Take is Andy Mannix. He's a reporter for the Star Tribune. He's covered the George Floyd killing story as in-depth and as complete as anyone over the last 5 years locally. And he joins me now. Andy, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
As you, you've been doing a lot of reporting the last few weeks on the five-year anniversary. As you and the your colleagues at the Star Tribune thought about what you wanted to take into consideration as you covered the last 5 years in race and George Floyd's killing, what was the goal? What did you want readers to take away?
Well, I think a lot of what happened in 2020 has reverberated through city, state politics and national politics throughout the past 5 years. So I think we saw the five-year anniversary is a good time to take stock. We've seen that we're in a very different moment than we were in 2020. We've seen the pendulum swing pretty far, the other way. I think due to a lot of factors, including violent crime rising in the past few years, as well as we have a story out that'll be in Sunday's paper just about the kind of revisionist history that some on the right have taken to sort of retelling the story in a more sympathetic light for Derek Chauvin and the other officers. So I think a combination between all of this stuff, the second term of Trump, We've seen quite a lot change. A lot of the promises made by private and public agencies in 2020 have been forgotten, I think, you know, related to DEI and all this stuff that came out of the Floyd moment in 2020 and we're seeing a backlash to right now.
And as you think about that, and as you continue to cover the city and the various elements and buckets of the story, are there places where you want to dig in more, or that you think there's still a lot to be told? What are you eager to kind of continue to tell about not just the anniversary, but how it's changed the city? We're in an election year, and obviously it'll be a conversation again this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of this is a moving target in a way. You know, I mean, what happened in 2020, again, I think has you know, put us on a path that we're still on today. So I think there's a lot to dig into, you know, including, like you say, there was a lot of promises from city officials who are up for re-election that were made during a moment when I think public sentiment was in a different place than it is now. So where are they on those today? You know, where are we on some of the pledges that were made to donate a certain amount of money to DEI causes from places like Target? We've seen them. You know, that's just an example of a local organization that's locally based organization that sort of changed course on the pledges that they made in 2020. And I think, you know, most importantly for people who live in Minneapolis, like what is the future of public safety? We still have a police department, largely because of what happened in 2020, that is down significantly, several hundred officers. I'm not sure what the latest count is, but you know, we're down to about as much as any police department in the city in terms of personnel. If people don't want to become police officers and we can't build those ranks back up, what does that mean for public safety in Minneapolis? You know, the chief has been in the news this week because of some comments that he made about like liberal bourgeoisie, you know, Minneapolis residents. The chief came in on a promise to rebuild trust with Minneapolis, the community here. So I think that there's a really interesting story about the leadership of the police department. So I think that all of this stuff is unfolding, and whether or not the Fry administration continues to stay in power or someone else takes over, you know, could really change the course of what happens next, including, like, there's, you know, the consent decree was, you know, the Trump administration made a motion to dissolve it, the federal consent decree this week. Assuming that that goes through, you know, the Fry and O'Hara and everyone else in leadership now says, well, we're still going to do all of those things. But, you know, if they're not in power anymore and public perception continues to change, will some of those things get abandoned without a federal monitor and a judge making sure that they're doing it and the kind of transparency that comes with the consent decree? So, again, I think all this stuff is a moving target, and it's yet to be what public safety is going to look like in Minneapolis.
Andy, you've covered this story from so many angles over the last few years. Are there parts of the story that you still go back to, or you think people should go back to and say, we wrote this story on this day, and that did or didn't happen, or that was a moving target? Because this story just is a life, and it's got these tentacles, and you've probably not written more than any of us have even read, or stuff that's been, you know, you're still researching, trying to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of what I look back at, you know, this sort of counter narrative that's emerged that we've seen Elon Musk and people with, you know, very close to the president promote that's been generating a lot of rumors, I guess, you know, unsubstantiated rumors about whether or not Derek Chauvin could be pardoned. I think that it's in light of all of that, it sort of behooves us to look back at, you know, to cut through the noise and look back at what the evidence was in the case. Because a lot of the way that it's being presented right now in these new narratives is, you know, some of it is based in truth, but is also contains just really flagrant inaccuracies or omissions to make it seem like something's happened that didn't. This was the most public trial we've ever had in Minnesota. We usually do not televise trials.
Right.
But because of the conditions of COVID, because of the international interest, the judge decided to do it. So all of it is there. The Andrew Baker, the Hennepin County medical examiner, his testimony is easily available on YouTube, where he says, that the cause of death was a homicide caused by these officers. That's been sort of twisted into this new narrative where people say that he said that Floyd died of a drug overdose, which is not true. So I think that, in terms of like how we move forward from this moment, there are a lot of different ways that we could go, but it should be based on actual facts and not a distortion of those facts. So those are some of the things that have been really interesting to me lately, is to see, these narratives that I kind of compare to that movie Don't Look Up. They're saying like, don't look at the video. That's not what happened. He wasn't killed by these officers. He was a bad guy which people can make whatever opinion, take whatever opinion they want about who George Floyd was a person, but the criminal case didn't really have anything to do with that. But there seems to be this narrative that says, because he has a criminal history, because he's a bad guy, he's really not worth all of the ways that, he was sort of held up as this example of what's wrong with policing in Minnesota. And again, people can take that position, but that has nothing to do with the criminal case. But all this is sort of being like glued together in this new narrative that positions this as, I think, something that we can, we can let the government officials and these companies that made these promises off the hook, because we can say, well, it actually didn't go down the way that we were all told it went down. I think people should draw their own conclusions about what happened and what should happen next. But again, I think it should be based on reality. So those are the things that I've been revisiting a lot lately, as we've just seen this new narrative become, really take root and become more of a mainstream take, like these, hashtag free Chauvin social media accounts and stuff are becoming really, really popular and getting a lot of attention. And again, I just want to draw people to like, this was a public trial. All this stuff is out there. All this testimony was out there. What the jury saw, you can go and watch on YouTube today.
My guest is Andy Mannix. He's a reporter for the Star Tribune. Andy, as you researched the story this morning about that, I saw it a couple days ago online. Does it seem organized, or does it seem to be one of these new trendy things that people want to promote, or they want to put it out there because it gets clicks or it gets people fired up, or somehow they're gaslighting somebody?
It's a really good question. I think it was not, especially because none of the people creating these would engage with us and sit down for an interview. It's hard to get in their heads. I think some of it is sort of like what the internet does, is it sort of gamifies the truth and tells you whether it's whether it's January 6th or 9/11 or Parkland shooting, that they sort of tell you, ooh, there's actually this whole other story, and now you're on the inside of it. And I think that that's enticing for some people on the internet. It is also, for a lot of the reasons I've said, like very politically convenient, I think, for the right to be able to say, to be able to align the left with rioting, with rising crime rates, with, saying these calls to abolish police, invited bad actors into the city, and this led to rising crime rates. For people like Paul Minneapolis, Liz Collin, who's married to Bob Kroll, who was kind of a main character in the saga of 2020 in Minneapolis, and is currently not allowed to be a police officer because of a settlement related to his actions in 2020 in the three most populous counties here in Minneapolis, or I'm sorry, in the Twin Cities. He's now up for, is a candidate for the U.S. Marshal, head U.S. Marshal in Minnesota. So I think that, that's an example of a way that sort of a lot, this narrative is convenient for him, and that it allows him to return to the public eye.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting because I have watched it, and so much of this is, it's probably a whole nother show of where you take a shred of fact And then you build a narrative around it. And we, you're right, we do see it on so many issues these days. Andy, I want to wrap up here, but anything to look forward to in the weeks ahead that on this story after today?
Well, you know, we had the consent decree lifted. That was sort of something that a lot of us expected would happen, just given Trump's positions on these sort of consent decrees in the past. So I think that, you know, we're all waiting to see if this pardon buzz is true or just rumors. But that's the next big one that we're paying attention to. Could there be pardons for Derek Chauvin or the other three officers?
What if you could see what's happening inside your body? Prenuvo's whole body scan screens for hundreds of conditions, including many solid tumors, as early as stage one, all in under an hour. And now, you can go beyond imaging with 80-plus blood biomarkers that help complete the picture. This Labor Day, save $300 off your scan when you book at Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Save $300 now through September 8th at Prenuvo.com. Terms and conditions apply.
Why does it feel like nobody really gives us the inside scoop? Join us on The Powers That Be, the podcast where insiders from Puck break down who has influence, how they use it, and what it actually means for you. New episodes every weekday. Listen to The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.
We're convicted of federal crimes and George Floyd's killing.
Andy Mannix, thanks for joining me on Sunday Take.
Thank you.
When we come back, this week's take. Welcome back to Sunday Take. This week's take is really just a reflection. As somebody who grew up in the suburbs and understood that a lot of people look like me, that as I traveled the world, as I traveled the country, and as diversity has grown in our communities, it's just given a different perspective. But 5 years ago was a whole new perspective, and looking at it since then, this is not to say that all of the debates and dialogue and dissent has been constructive. And as an absolute First Amendment person, I think it's good that we've had these debates and this discussion about race and policing. But here we are 5 years later, and I think the one thing I take from it is consciousness. I'm much more conscious of how race has played out in our community. And as a native of this community, I think that helps. And it goes to show that even middle-aged white guys can learn things and reflect. And so I think that's what my take this week is, that hopefully we can all reflect, have some perspective, and remind ourselves where we sit in our community and what our role is. Nakima said that she doesn't know that it's good to trust institutions. I'm going to think about that. But I'm also going to think that it's very clear to me that the generations younger than mine have a perspective much younger and much different than ours. And so that gives me hope that we could solve some of these problems going forward. That's the Sunday Take. Enjoy your weekend.
Girl, let's get real. Some pads are just diapers with a good PR team. But not the new Kotex BioCare. That's because Kotex BioCare helps defend against odor and irritants. And it's the first and only pad with this pH proactive system that helps optimize the pad's pH. Just think of it as self-care for down there. Check out Kotex.com for more details on the all-new Kotex, completely redesigned to meet your needs. You asked, we heard.
What you're listening to presumably doesn't suck, so neither should your sound system. Sonos lets you listen seamlessly from room to room. Same great sound, expertly tuned, astonishingly clear. It's not magic, but it's not not magic.